This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. Thomas Moyer's death last week stunned and saddened Ohio's judicial system and Capitol Square. Moyer had some health issues, but the death of the 70-year-old Supreme Court justice caught nearly everyone off guard. Moyer was set to leave the court. He was set to retire at the end of his term, and candidates were already campaigning to succeed him. He served 22 years as the Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court. Serving with him much of that time was Judith Ann Lanzinger. Justice Lanzinger, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Mike.
What's your favorite memory of Tom Moyer?
Well, I have to say my favorite memory leads to how soft he was inside. We would deliberate, and the seven of us would oftentimes go to dinner afterwards. And as you know, people would be on diets, and no one would decide to order a dessert, except we could always count on the chief because he had a sweet tooth. And he would order a dessert, and he would order enough forks for everybody at the table, and he would take a bite and pass it around. And so I think he brought the sweetness to the court, apart from everything else, of course.
Putting acrimony of whatever disagreements were evident earlier in the day, and you all could sort of break bread or chocolate cake or whatever together.
Exactly.
Joining us on the phone from downtown is Columbus Dispatch senior editor Joe Hallett, who covered Tom Moyer at the State House throughout his entire career at the State House, Tom Moyer's career. Joe, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks, Mike.
What is your favorite memory of the Chief Justice?
Well, it is a memory that he would not like me to remember or anyone else. And frankly, he wasn't really involved in it, but for a reporter, it was an amazing story. And that was in 1991. The whole situation just was totally counter to, as Justice Lanzinger described, the chief's very mild manner, inclusive, generous personality. And that was in 1991 when a fight broke out between two justices of the Ohio Supreme Court, the late Craig Wright and Andy Douglas, in the chamber of then Justice Alice Robey Resnick. And Justice Douglas ended up with several broken ribs.
So this was more than an argument.
Oh, yeah. This was an actual fight. And I spoke with the chief afterwards. And if you knew the chief, he was just horrified by the whole situation and embarrassed by it. But, you know, for a reporter, it was one of the most unusual stories I ever had to cover. Unfortunately, it came on his watch, even though he had nothing to do with it.
Justice Lanzinger, that's the word you keep hearing over and over again in the memories of Tom Moyer, is gentleman, that he was a gentleman in the purest sense of the word.
Absolutely. He totally defined the term. And you think about it, a chief justice has a position that for many people might be considered, you know, the epitome of a legal career. Certainly, Tom Moyer wore his position very lightly. He was a humble man, and that's one of the real joys of those of us who knew him, in memory of him.
We're speaking to Justice Lanzinger from the Ohio Supreme Court and also Joe Hallett from the Columbus Dispatch about the life of Tom Moyer, the Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, who passed away last week. Joe Hallett, gentleman, also describes your dealings with him?
Oh, absolutely. I once wrote a column describing him as Mr. Rogers. He had that kind of gentle nature. And I think more than anything, when you think about his legacy on the court, more than anything, he restored dignity to the court. I arrived at the State House in 85, and there was continual rancor on the court under the late Chief Justice Frank Celebrezze. And I covered that first campaign between Chief Justice Moyer and Frank Celebrezze, and it, too, was a rancorous campaign, one that the Chief Justice Moyer did not like because it was totally against his nature. But despite the fight that occurred later on and all the things that all the other controversies that may have cropped up during his time on the court, I still think that Justice Moyer brought collegiality to the court and made it a body that Ohioans could be proud of.
you couldn't help but notice a sort of like a Ben Franklin, Thomas Jeffersonian coincidence that the two men died not too far apart from each other.
Exactly, two weeks or so. Mm-hmm. There's another coincidence, too, that I was looking at when I was thinking about the situation, and that is 145 years ago, on Good Friday, Abraham Lincoln was shot, mm-hmm. and then, of course, died the next morning. Our chief passed away on Good Friday, April 2nd of this year, and that's a real loss, a leader to the state of Ohio.
It's kind of ironic that this hard-fought victory, which put him in the Chief Justice chair, from that position, he championed judicial election reform. Was it because of that experience and that campaign that prompted him to ask for things like merit selection of judges for the first time around, no election of judges the first time around?
Right. I know Joe and I probably have known the chief for the same amount of time, over the last 24 years or so. And he has always been so concerned about the integrity of the judiciary and the perception that the public has that judges are trying to be neutral, trying to be independent and fair to all sides. So the chief's concern, I think, was the idea that so much money is being put into campaigns that the public may have a misperception that justice can be bought. And really, I think that the idea of changing judicial selection was his concern about the money that is in judicial races.
And Joe, he was using his last months in office to really beat this drum about trying to change how judges are selected in Ohio.
Yeah, I had lunch with him. I guess it's probably been September, but we talked a lot about this, and he said that this is one of the causes he wanted to pursue and champion in retirement, and try to get the way, change the way we elect justices. As Justice Lanzinger said, he was very concerned about the public perception that money influenced decisions on the court, and in the last two Supreme Court elections, the political arm of the Chamber of Commerce spent $2.3 million on television airtime to support four Republican candidates, and the chief steadfastly denied that campaign contributions had anything to do with decisions. But again, he was very worried that the public perception was that, in fact, decisions followed money. And so he wanted merit selection, a gubernatorially appointed Supreme Court, through a process that would bring in lawyers and lay people and so forth to make recommendations. Unfortunately, he was never able to see it through.
We're speaking with Joe Hallett from the Columbus Dispatch and Judith Ann Lanzinger from the Ohio Supreme Court on the legacy of the late Chief Justice Thomas Moyer on All Sides on WOSU. You can join our conversation, 292-8513, or send an email at allsides@wosu.org. Justice Lanzinger, he was a progressive. He was conservative politically, but also a progressive in the way he viewed the courts and technology. He brought technology into the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. Those people on the technological side would give him tremendous credit, not only for the court network, but for the website of the Supreme Court. Anyone can Google Ohio Supreme Court and get right onto our website, and it gives you all the information you could ever want about what the court is doing, including cases that have been accepted, that are scheduled. You can watch the oral arguments as they occur. You can see the opinions. You can read the opinions yourself. And we have a wealth of information for the public to see about what we do.
Well, Justice Lanzinger and I were speaking about this the night Chief Justice Moyer died, and she pointed out very appropriately that the chief was very interested in making the court accessible to citizens. He took the court on the road, was the first Chief Justice ever to do that, and I think Justice Lanzinger estimated that probably 50,000 students across Ohio watched the court in action.
Yes, at least that.
And the court building was restored under him, renovated. under him, and there is a magnificent education center, interactive education center, in the basement of the court that students go to see. And one of the other things he did was he was very involved in the rule of law projects, and he helped the Ukraine set up its judicial system after the fall of communism there in 1992, and he helped. He went to Argentina and China and Costa Rica, and was on panels that helped advise them on refurbishing, you know, redirecting their own judicial systems.
Justice Lansing, on the day-to-day work of the Supreme Court, how would he preside over arguments? How would he guide, you know, rulings and things like that? What kind of administrator was he?
I'd say just a great leader. He had a temperament for it. One of the things a good leader, I think, does is have tremendous patience with colleagues. And as you know, there's seven people on the court. Not everyone agreed. Joe and other folks might occasionally say the all-Republican Supreme Court. But if you were in deliberations, you would see how each individual justice can view the same case very differently. Justice Moyer, being the chief, would first give his view of what the case was about. We would go around the table in seniority, and then we would vote in reverse seniority. So even though we had just heard the case, there might be a very spirited discussion about different points of view. And the chief never cut anybody off before that person was finished. And even though maybe some other justice might be concerned that we were taking inordinate amount of time on issues that were already addressed, the chief never made the individual feel as though their thoughts were not worthy of consideration. I think that's a very important thing.
Joe, one of the cases that came before the Supreme Court during his time that, you know, it's been resolved but really hasn't been resolved, is education reform. Was there frustration on his part that that wasn't settled once and for all?
Well, I think so. Actually, during his tenure, there were four landmark school funding rulings by the court. The last one just finally dismissed the, you know, kicked it out of the Supreme Court and effectively dismissed it without a resolution that I think was satisfactory to many folks. But he generally was in the minority on those school funding decisions, but they did lead to reform, whether it was intended or not. As a result of those decisions, we now have equity funding for poor schools in Ohio, where they're, because their tax bases don't raise enough money, they are awarded more from the state to try and equalize funding. Schools, we have the school building construction program, multi-billion-dollar program with new schools across the state, all resulting from those landmark school funding cases. I think even though he didn't like them, he might have been happy with some of the results.
Justice Lansinger.
And Joe, you're right. This is a good example of how the chief respected the other branches of government as well. One of the things that he was a master at is understanding the role of judges, and he never wanted to intrude on policy decisions that were to be made by the General Assembly. Mm-hmm. So, as you said, the court acted, the legislature, the General Assembly reacted, and there was progress that was made. But the chief was very concerned about not being the one to make law from the bench. And so that was his part of his legacy.
Joe, we'll give you the political question. What's next? The governor can't appoint a replacement, will he, before the election in November?
Well, I think he will. The question is who, and the political appointment would be for him to name Franklin County Probate Judge Eric Brown to the court. He's a Democrat running for Chief Justice against the current Justice Maureen O'Connor, the Republican. My personal feeling is that might be a mistake. For one thing, it would be pretty unwieldy to have both Brown and O'Connor sitting on the same bench while they're running against each other. And two, I think it would be perceived as a political move to give Brown a leg up. I think we might see might take some instruction from what Governor Strickland did when Mark Dayen resigned as Attorney General. He put in Nancy Rogers, who was a law school dean at Ohio State, acceptable to all parties. My guess is Governor Strickland will do something like that, put a non-political person in the chief's office to serve out the rest of the year, the rest of the chief justice's term.
Okay. We'll have to wrap it up. Thanks, Joe Hallett from the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Justice Lenzinger from the House Supreme Court. Funeral arrangements are still being worked out, but we'll look for something perhaps later this week. But thanks for your time, remembering Chief Justice Thomas Moyer.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Joe.
When we come back, we'll look at the U.S. Supreme Court and the landmark campaign financing decision from earlier this year, when All Sides continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Nearly a year ago, Merchant Marine Captain Richard Phillips became the first American seaman to be captured by pirates in two centuries. He tried to escape, but was caught and beaten. 5 days into the ordeal, Navy SEAL sniper shot and killed three of his captors. He has a new memoir. On the next Fresh Air, we hear Captain Phillips' story. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Join the conversation and be a part of the studio audience as WOSU Public Media hosts a town hall forum. Moderated by WOSU's Ann Fisher, panelists and audience participants will discuss the issues that face one of our community's most vibrant neighborhoods, the Short North. The one-hour televised forum will be held April 22nd at 6 p.m. at the Battelle Studios at WOSU at COSI. To be a part of the live studio audience, call 688-3777 or visit wosu.org/Columbus Neighborhoods. That's wosu.org/Columbus Neighborhoods. 72 degrees in downtown Columbus, mostly sunny skies today, and a little windy, wind gusts of up to 40 miles per hour. We could hit a record high temperature of 82 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 58. Sunshine and a chance of rain for Wednesday, a high of 78. All Sides continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. As individuals, we have certain rights. We have the right to privacy, due process in a court of law, and the right to speak freely. As individuals, we can spend as much as we want to exercise that right to free speech, but few of us can afford it. But corporations can afford it. Large labor unions can afford it. And thanks to a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court, corporations and unions and large groups such as those have similar rights to individuals. In its Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission decision, the High Court ruled corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money on political free speech. We'll discuss the case and look at the issue of whether a corporation should be given the same rights as an individual during this segment of All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. Joining us is Greg Coleridge, director of the Northeast Ohio American Friends Service Committee, a community organizing group. He joins us from his office in Cuyahoga Falls. Greg, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
And also Bradley Smith, a Capital University Law School professor and former chair of the Federal Election Commission. He joins us in studio. Bradley, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Greg.
Bradley, should a corporation have the same rights as an individual?
Well, corporations clearly have certain constitutional rights, and they don't have them because they're corporations. It's not that corporations are people, but nor are they elves or bicycles or trees. Corporations are made up of people, so they have rights just as people have rights. So you and I can get together, we can go out on the street corner, and we can associate to speak. The mere fact that we incorporate to do that doesn't suddenly deprive us of our rights to speak. And the question, therefore, is really not whether corporations are people And I'm glad we've avoided that formulation so far, whether they have the same rights as persons. Mm-hmm. The question is, what rights do they have? And in my view, they have all the rights that the people who make them up would have. So they don't have a right to run for office. I mean, you know, three of us couldn't get together and say, well, the three of us are running for governor. We're going to split the job. You know, they don't have the right to vote. We don't vote in a group like that. They don't have the right to invoke the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination, just as you cannot in a criminal conspiracy invoke the Fifth Amendment right for one of your other conspirators. If he wants to spill his guts, he can. But we have the right to associate as people. We have the right to speak as people, and that's what corporations do. And if we didn't do that, the consequences would be very significant. Take, for example, the American Friends Services Committee Incorporated. That's the official name of Greg's group. If it were had no rights simply because it was a corporation, the government could come in and take its property without due process. I work for a corporation, Capital University. Can the government come in and in violation of what would appear to be the Third Amendment, start quartering soldiers in our dorms on the grounds that, well, you're a corporation, you don't have rights? Obviously, corporations have rights, and we need to figure out what.
Greg, what's your opinion on this? What's the danger of giving corporations this free speech right?
Well, I think that business corporations in particular already have an enormous amount of constitutional rights that goes back really beginning a century and a quarter ago, 1886, and almost like a salami over the last 124 years have amassed these never intended constitutional, good deal of them, Bill of Rights protections that were reserved initially by our founders exclusively for human beings, for people, not for business corporations. And that was done for a very good reason. Those who founded this state, those who founded this country, were fearful of the conglomerate, the compilation of property, this artificial legal fiction that we know of as the business corporation, of becoming too politically powerful, of being more powerful, in fact, than human beings, and began a series, again, 124 years ago, of taking a very activist position, not intended by our founders to anoint them with constitutional rights, including the rights of being involved in our political process, which I think has corrupted and usurped the political process and made it very difficult for those of us who don't bring money to the political table, who don't have some of these powers that business corporations have, to have our voices heard, to have our needs met, to have our communities served.
Bradley, is that – I mean, obviously a corporation like General Electric can spend a lot more money than Joe the electrician. Is there a danger in giving the same rights to such a large, affluent organization?
Well, again, I'd say the first thing we need to do is think about, again, what exactly is the issue. For example, it's just wrong to say that the founders did not intend for corporations to have rights or that these Bill of Rights were exclusively for human beings. Again, corporations have rights because they're made up of human beings. If a corporation didn't have rights, corporate offices could be searched without a warrant. You could be sitting there in your office. Probably WSU is incorporated. Ohio State's incorporated. Mm-hmm. Police could just come right in here and start searching the studios right now, tell us to get out at gunpoint. You know, again, the rights are there because people are there, and there's nothing to suggest that corporations weren't intended to have rights. Common law, before the Constitution, corporations were recognized as having rights. Long before the 1886 case, Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railroad, which I think Greg is referring to, where the court holds that they have equal protection rights, courts had recognized that corporations had rights. So that's one question, and I think that's not a question that we need to be hung up on. The question then is, as you framed it, should corporations be allowed to participate, or unions as well, in the political system to the same extent? And my belief is generally yes, and that's based on two reasons. One is first principles. It's people ought to have a right to speak, and it's very dangerous to put the government in the position of deciding who speaks and who doesn't. And two is, as a practical matter, I think it actually has worked generally for the benefit of our system to have wide open, robust debate, as few limits as possible. The more restrictions you put on, the more it favors those in power and their ability to play games with the system.
The corporations, there are rules. I mean, they can't give to individual candidates. Now, if under your interpretation of the rights of a corporation. Shouldn't a corporation or a large union be allowed to give to candidate X or candidate Y under those same that same theory?
Well, I think that's a bona fide position. And the question, for example, in Ohio, a wealthy individual can give $10,000 to a candidate for office. Now, some people don't think they should be able to do that, but recognize that should be, in my mind, separate from the idea of what a corporation versus an individual can do. I'm not sure why if Les Wexner can give $10,000 to a candidate, it's any more of a problem than if the Limited simply writes a check for $10,000 to a candidate.
Greg Coleridge. Nonprofit groups, MoveOn.org, have organized and been able to give, make political speech, run ads, Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, another organization. Why can't corporations be given the same rights as those groups?
Well, you know, I do want to look at this question of personhood because I do think it is salient. It is at the center. This is not the decision. The decision, Citizens versus you. United versus FEC, is not, I would argue, at its root about free speech. It is at its root instead, I believe, about expanding corporate constitutional rights. You know, early on in our state and in many states of this country, there was rigid controls that our state legislatures imposed on corporations, saying that corporations, through the chartering process, could the corporations could only be chartered one at a time, that land ownership was limited, that directors had to live in the state, that corporations could not be involved in the political process. They did this very intentionally, very deliberately, because they recognized that these entities were creations of the state, by extension, creations of we the people, and that we the people should not bestow upon these artificial legal fictions powers to be equal to us, let alone greater than us. And when you give business corporations political powers, the rights to be involved in the political process, now you have distorted the political arena. You are giving these entities much greater power to influence the body politic because
they have
greater resources to bring to the political table.
How is that different than what MoveOn.org does? They have much greater resources to bring to the political table.
Well, you know, again, individuals do not have the same powers than organized entities do, like corporations. So I would have no problem with prohibiting all forms of corporations from being involved in the political process.
Both nonprofit and for-profit.
I would have no problem. But I believe that, again, that could be something that we could distinguish because, again, these entities are created by us individually and collectively through the state legislature. Historically, in this state and across the country, corporations were prohibited from being involved, either directly or indirectly, including in Ohio, in politics, in lobbying, in being involved in either direct or indirect, being involved in referendum or initiative campaigns, as well as contributing to candidates. That was the law for many decades in the state. We could make a distinction if we so chose, if we thought that for-profit corporations were distorting or perverting the body politic to a greater extent or to a more fundamental extent than nonprofit corporations. We don't have to make a sweeping distinct or sweeping generalization upon all corporations. If we so felt it was more important for business corporations, to for-profit corporations, to control them and define them, we could do that.
We're speaking about the Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. Is it Federal Election Commission or Communications Commission?
Federal Election Commission.
Election Commission, that's what I thought. The case that gave corporations, large organizations like labor unions, the ability to spend unlimited amounts of money on political free speech. Our guest you just heard, Greg Coleridge, is the director of the Northeast Ohio American Friends Service Committee, based up in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, and Bradley Smith, Capital University Law School professor and former chair of the Federal Election Commission. We welcome your calls at 292-8513 and your emails at allsides@wosu.org. Cliff, you're on the air.
Would you agree that fundamentally the purpose and effect of Citizens United was to make global corporate CEOs equal to individual multibillionaires who, under Buckley versus Valeo, have the ability to spend unlimited amounts of their personal funds to influence elections, candidate elections?
First, let's talk about the Buckley case. What's, for those of us who didn't go to law school, what happened in that case? Anybody?
Well, Buckley v. Valeo is a seminal campaign finance case decided in January of 1976. And what that case holds is that the government can only regulate political speech, which includes spending money to support candidates, in order to prevent corruption or its appearance. And it holds that, therefore, people can spend as much money as they want as long as they don't give it to candidates or work in conjunction with candidates. The idea being that if they're not talking to candidates, there's no corruption. But the government can limit amounts given directly to candidates because that has the possibility to negotiate a sort of a quid pro quo.
Or another way to look at it is sort of the shorthand non-legal is it equated money with free speech. Money with property.
What the court actually says is that money is necessary to facilitate speech, and if you limit money specifically because it's being spent on speech, that's a First Amendment problem. And you can think about that. Imagine if the government were to pass a law saying the Columbus Dispatch could only spend, $25,000 a year to publish. I mean, it would immediately go out of business. You can't publish the newspaper for $25,000. And so the court recognized that the links between speech and money are very serious. And it's worth noting for anybody who doubts that. Since that decision, 19 different judges have sat on the Supreme Court, and only one of them has ever suggested that these regulations should not be analyzed as First Amendment issues.
Greg Coleridge, your take on money as free speech?
Well, I don't think money is free speech. Money is property. And if you have more money, you have more speech. And it distorts and discombobulates, I think, the ability of community organizations, of community individuals, of people who don't bring a lot of money to the political table. And it's no wonder why you have such wide disenchantment in our communities and across our country with politicians of all stripes. It's because they don't believe that they're being authentically heard. I think it creates more of a democratic theme park than a democratic actuality or reality. So long as we continue under this system where, it's like corporations. Within corporations, one can say, well, shareholders vote, but it's not an equal vote. It's not one person, one vote. It's one share, one vote. And if you have more shares, you have more votes. How democratic is that? Same goes, I think, in our society, where you have $1, one vote. The well-to-do people, they're going to have their voices heard. They're going to have greater access to decision makers. They're going to have the ability to, in the marketplace, so to speak, if that's what you want to call it, have a greater opportunity to frame their issues in ways they think is important at the detriment of most of us who don't bring a lot of money to the political table. I would argue that's not very democratic.
Bradley Smith, you sat on the Federal Election Commission. You dealt with campaign finance law and regulations and enforcing the rules that were in place. What do you see happening 5 years down the road because of this ruling and the freedom that corporations and unions have to spend as they wish?
Well, the ruling is very important, and yet at the same time it's not so apocalyptic as some of its critics would view it as. I mean, it is important. I think you will see more money spent and you will see corporations getting involved in spending money. And personally, I think by and large that's a good thing. I'm a more speech guy is better. But we need to remember that a majority of the states, representing about 60% of the American population, already conduct all of their state elections under exactly this regime and have for years, for governors, secretary of state, state legislatures, and so on. And we don't see corporations coming in and dominating those elections, nor is there any evidence that those states are more poorly governed in some way. Many of the best-governed states, in fact, the Pew Charitable Trust and Governing Magazine do a survey every couple of years of the best-governed states. And the six best-governed states in that survey, in the last survey, all allowed unlimited corporate contributions or, corporate expenditures in political races. So it's an important decision, but we should remember it doesn't go over the top. And I'll add one other point on this. During the 1990s, when corporations could spend money on soft money, which was ads that didn't specifically urge you to vote for a candidate but could say, this candidate's a really bad guy, call him up and tell him not to do these things, right? During that time, which was stopped by the McCain-Feingold bill and then will be allowed again under Citizens United, but during that time, public confidence in government went steadily upwards. And almost from the day we stopped that, public confidence in government has gone down. So the data is simply inconsistent with Craig's point that people are disenchanted with this.
Let's go take a break and we'll come back and we'll continue our discussion on the Citizens United case that gives corporations and labor unions the ability to spend unlimited amounts of fund on political speech. We'll continue our discussion when we return on WOSU 820.
Nearly a year ago, Merchant Marine Captain Richard Phillips became the first American seaman to be captured by pirates in two centuries. He tried to escape, but was caught and beaten. 5 days into the ordeal, Navy SEAL sniper shot and killed three of his captors. He has a new memoir. On the next Fresh Air, we hear Captain Phillips' story. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU TV, WOSU presents the documentary The Buddha, Explore an Extraordinary Journey on the Buddha, Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU TV. 72 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:41. Sunny skies today. We could reach a record high of 82 degrees. Clear skies tonight, a low of 58 degrees. Sunshine for Wednesday and a good chance of rain showers, maybe some thunderstorms on Wednesday, and a high of 78. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're speaking with Greg Coleridge from the director. He is the director of the Northeast Ohio American Friends Service Committee, a community organizing group based up near Cleveland, and Bradley Smith, Capital University law professor and former chair of the Federal Elections Commission. We're talking about the Citizens United case that was decided by the Supreme Court, and specifically we're looking at the issue of whether a corporation has the same rights or similar rights that an individual has. Greg, I want to pick up on what Bradley was talking about as far as the political system. As I watched the news coverage, you know, after this decision, I was left with, okay, yeah, they have the rights to – they have the official right now to spend unlimited amounts of money on political speech. And I said, frankly, big deal. Haven't they been doing that in other ways for years? Whether it's through PACs or through soft money or through 527 groups or getting their employees to give to candidates and things like that. Is it really going to change the influence corporations have on the political system?
Well, there's part of me that agrees with that. It has been going on in this way with business corporations finding ways to exert their political influence. Again, something that was not intended by those who founded this state, that was not part of what the framers cared to do. Again, business corporations were closely defined and rigidly controlled, subordinate to we the people through our elected representatives, because they feared these entities becoming too big and disturbing and dislodging human beings from being involved in the political process. But this process of being involved in politics, corporations have been a la a salami for the past 124 years. This decision in of itself is not a cataclysmic one, but it does make conditions worse. Rather than maybe a single slice, it's three or four slices. I think you will see some negative effects. I mean, I suspect corporate CEOs and their like are pretty smart. They'll lay low this year, but maybe not so in judicial races. This year, candidates in 18 states will face off to fill 34 Supreme Court seats. And I suspect that in the judicial realm, you will see business corporations pull money, which this law now permits, directly out of their corporate coffers. Meaning, if you go to Walmart and you buy something from them, Walmart can take part of the profits, meaning part of the money that you spent there, and spend it in ways that they feel is important in campaigns to either elect or unelect candidates that, again, they feel are important. And in the judicial realm, it's particularly important because judges make decisions all the time.
Bradley Smith from Capital Law School. If you're a Walmart customer, to use that example, and you don't like the way that their corporation has contributed, what are the chances the corporations are going to say, you know, okay, we're not going to give to this cause or you know, too bad, we're going to give anyway and risk losing customers?
Well, corporations tend not to like to risk losing customers. You know, years ago, Michael Jordan was asked why he didn't endorse a particular political candidate, and his response was, Republicans buy shoes too. Corporations prefer to exercise their influence using another of our First Amendment liberties, the right to petition government, that is through lobbying and so on. So that's why one reason why I don't think you're going to see this torrent of corporate spending by large corporations coming out. But corporations often have very important interests here. For example, if you're in a town and a corporation is employing 6,000 people in the town, let's take a real example. You've got a governor in the state who says, I'm not going to accept stimulus money. That happened last year in a couple places. Shouldn't the corporation be able to say, look, if you don't accept stimulus money, we're going to shed 200 jobs in this town? People should be able to hear that message, and the corporation is the proper vehicle to bring that message out to life.
Let's go to the phones. Jeff, you're on the air on WOSU.
Hi there. I had a point. I appreciate you taking my call. I had a point I wanted to make. Somebody, I believe was might have been you, mentioned what's the difference between a corporation spending money on a political candidate and Move On, companies like Move On, or corporations like MoveOn.org. And MoveOn.org is, in and of itself, a political organization made up of people with the exact or very similar political bent. And so all those people are speaking in one voice when that corporation, MoveOn.org, gives money, whereas a particular corporation like Walmart or IBM or whatever is a mix of many different people with many different political bents, they are hired there usually not based upon their political affiliation, but just on whether or not they can perform the job. And so then if the corporation is speaking but with its money by donating it to a particular political candidate or political organization, then they are speaking. The executives, the board is speaking with one voice for a group of people who may not feel the same way. And I just wondered how you feel about that. I'll take my answer off the air.
Great, thank you, Jeff. Bradley, your take on that?
Well, again, corporations, we need to separate these issues out. Again, the question can't be, do corporations have rights? If corporations don't have rights, then next year we could very well have a Republican governor, a Republican state legislature. The American Friends Services Committee Incorporated, where Greg Wright works, has endorsed a lot of very liberal political causes. Presumably that Republican legislature and governor could come in, seize all their property, and pass a rule saying they can't speak. And if Greg tried to raise his First Amendment rights, we would just say, well, you're a corporation. You've got no First Amendment rights. That can't be the case. Again, what we need to focus on is who we want to stop. Now, Greg has a couple times slipped in, well, business corporations. So there we begin to see a difference, and the idea that it's all corporations starts to fall by the wayside. And then sometimes he said, well, big corporations, and that's another difference. We need to focus on what is really the evil that we want to pursue, and then you have to have, under constitutional law, and I think good policy, what in law is called a narrowly tailored solution. That is something that identifies the evil, and I think Greg sees that, I think. I don't mean to speak for him, but I think if I parse through everything he says, I think he sees it as large for-profit corporations. And then you need to think about what should be the solution to that. And that would get us into a different debate, and I think a more meaningful one, which is what are the benefits or evils of trying to regulate that type of behavior in particular.
Greg, your take on that?
Well, I think there is a distinction to be made between non-profit corporations that oftentimes are involved in charitable purposes, or if they are educational or advocacy or even lobbying, they're promoting certain ideas. But a business corporation, they're in the business. In fact, they have a fiduciary responsibility that will be held by shareholders and the like to make money. I mean, that's what primarily they're in the business for. So what they do is all geared to trying to make money. Sometimes it's geared to make the most money possible. And if that is your principal primary modus operandi, your primary function for receiving your license, your charter, then what you do is not always in the community interest. And therefore, I think it's very important that we, as a society, and that's where the chartering process comes in, and that's where laws and rules are so important, it behooves us to make sure that if you have an entity whose sole purpose is to make money, then we have to make sure that they are controlled, and that being involved in the political process, I think, can be very dangerous. Now, it should be said that all of the individuals from CEO down to the janitor of every corporation of whatever size we're talking about has their full complement of individual rights. They can stand up any day of the week and say whatever they want to say, contribute whatever they want to contribute within the existing campaign finance laws, be involved in lobbying and doing everything. Nothing is preventing that, and I am not asserting that that should be controlled. But we're talking about a business corporation here that is fundamentally different from the entity itself, from the individuals that make it up, because individuals come and go. They die. They leave. They move away. They become involved in a different company.
Let's get Bradley Smith to respond to this, then we'll take a call. Go ahead, Bradley.
Well, again, a lot there. But, I mean, one argument that could be made is that a business company is much less threatening than a nonprofit political company such as, well, the American Friends Services Committee. I mean, I'm sure that Greg believes what he's doing is for the good of the community, but that doesn't mean that others believe that. You know, corporations, this idea that they're creatures of the state is ridiculous. If you go down to the corporate office here in Columbus and you ask them, do you make corporations, they would either laugh at you or stare at you dumbfounded. People make corporations, and the law recognizes that. For example, if we didn't treat corporations as people, you couldn't sue a corporation. You have to find all the individual shareholders. Then, so once we parse that out, we get into, again, what's the real issue? And I think the real issue seems to be this notion of bigness. Now, let's look at what the Citizens United case actually did. The government's position in that case was that if a corporation was doing it, because it was a corporation, the government could censor the publication or sale of a book by a corporation such as Random House or Barnes & Noble, that it could censor the distribution of a book through Nook or Amazon's Kindle, that it could censor the distribution of a movie distributed by a corporation, that it could prevent a union from hiring a writer to write a political pamphlet. And so, again, it's very dangerous to get into this notion of just thinking that corporations or unions are the problem. Let's think about the issue of bigness. And if we get there, then we have to – I think the first thing we have to think about counterbalancing that concern about bigness, which I think people have and is legitimate concern, is the concern about having government decide who's too big, who needs to speak more, who's spoken too much.
Let's get to the phones. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Gentlemen, this half-hour segment is one of the best I have heard in some time. I'm a big fan of Ann Fisher's, don't get me wrong. But Mike, Bradley, Greg, this is a really important issue. Bradley, despite being a CAPU alum myself, but not an attorney, I just have to say some of your argument is spacious, if not completely disingenuous. You know, the bigness and the people could come in and a SWAT team could be smothered by corporate lawyers in the first 30 seconds of an investigation.
Not if there are no constitutional rights. You're relying on the very idea that the corporation has constitutional rights that can call in lawyers to stop. And Greg's denying that.
Well, I'm going to just make and I have a point of view. It's not – I'm not, trying to just be devil's advocate. Corporations – and I've worked for corporations. I'm retired now, but – pardon me, sir. A diffusion of responsibility, you know, if you say, well, our first order of business is to make money for our shareholders. Yes, great. I mean, you know, who – yeah, as a shareholder, who wouldn't want that? But that does not in any way contribute to the comity, to the greater good of a community. And I understand the fiduciary responsibility is there. You know, that's, you know, corporation is set up to make money.
Okay, Paul, I'm going to get your response here. Go ahead, Bradley.
You presume that these analogies are silly, but only because you presume that, in fact, corporations have rights to call in their lawyers. Mm-hmm. And again, I think you just have to look at the notion that corporations spend money on all kinds of things now. They give money to controversial charities such as Planned Parenthood or even the Boy Scouts now is controversial because of its stands on gay rights. They spend money to support the symphony and the opera. And all of these things are handled under what in law is called the business judgment rule. We allow the corporate directors to do this. We could restrict that a lot, but there's very little cause that's been made or argument that's been made as to why we should restrict that specifically and only for political activity.
Greg, let's get to this notion that size of a corporation should be perhaps regulated. I mean, how do you go about? We've heard a lot with this banking regulation legislation that's moving through the Congress or being debated in Congress. Too big to fail. What size organization is too big to speak, or speak unlimitedly, if that's a word?
Well, let me just say before, I know time is moving, and for people who may want to get a little more of a dose of this whole issue. The Kerwin Institute on campus of OSU next Monday.
Yeah, 6 o'clock at the Moritz College of Law is holding
a panel discussion on corporate personhood.
Yeah, both folks here will be on that. Yes, we encourage you to check that out as well.
So that's at Saxby Auditorium, and people want to partake in cussing and discussing this issue further. I mean, we could spend a lot more time than we have now to look at size, and I think in part size does matter. But I think, you know, it goes back to what I think this whole issue has been from the beginning, a false framing. Do we limit speech in order to have free and fair elections, is sort of argued by some, or do we accept corporate-dominated political debate in order to preserve free speech, is sort of what others claim. Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is profoundly a false dilemma, and it evaporates if we reject from the moment that corporations should have personhood rights. If we pretend that corporations are persons under the Constitution, then limiting corporate speech is a constitutional infringement and a violation of it. I just think that, you know, that the framing of the issue is one where we have to look at the whole issue and the whole problem of personhood. That's the problem. You know, what was it, a century and a half ago or 150 years ago, people finally began to realize that slavery was a legal fiction, that a person is property. And I think today we have to understand that corporate personhood is the legal fiction, that property is a person. How can you give Bill of Rights protection to property? I mean, there's other protections and other rights that property should have.
Well, Greg,
Bill of Rights protections, that to me is bizarre.
Let me ask one question, then I'm going to get Bradley on the size issue. But he makes up a good point that if you can sue a corporation, that basically they have as an individual, why can't the corporation be able to speak as an individual?
Well, there have been instances where corporations have certain protections now, but to have Bill of Rights protections. You know, again, going back, corporations early on had no – if they were sued, if they violated their charter, they could be dissolved. They had no ability, so to speak, to quote-unquote defend themselves because their charter was a privilege. It was a democratic instrument. And there was – you know, to be sued in a sense – says that they have certain kind of equal rights. That wasn't the case. They had no rights, including the rights of being searched. Books were considered open in a good many cases of corporations. That was in original charters of companies chartered right here in the state of Ohio.
Greg, 10 seconds, rebuttal?
I'd say it's a practical matter. I mean, again, that's just not the reality. As early as 1819, the Supreme Court recognized that corporations have rights. And again, I think we need to go back to thinking about, do we want the government regulating speech? And that's really the key question. And whether that speech comes from a corporation or an individual shouldn't matter.
Okay. That wraps up our discussion. For more, this is going to be a panel discussion at the Moritz College of Law, Monday, April 12th, 6 o'clock, Saxby Auditorium. My thanks to my guests, Bradley Smith and Greg Coleridge. Both will be on that panel next week. I'm Mike Thompson on WOSU 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org.